the theme, the new theme that we're going to be looking at is, we're calling it Buddhism through time and space. Buddhism through time and space. So we'll be looking at how Buddhism has developed and expressed itself in different times and places. How the Dharma has been practiced in different countries, in different epochs, in different cultures. And what this can tell us about how we can practice and live more according to the Dharma. So we certainly won't here and now, how we can practice here and now. So we certainly won't be looking at this in a sort of academic sense of an interest in the history of Buddhism, as an academic might have it. We'll be using this as a way of exploring how we can make our practice of the Dharma more effective. How we can become more the sort of people that we've got the potential to be. How we can live more fulfilled lives. How we can build the sort of spiritual community that's going to support us here and now. Because we live in really different times from the times of the Buddha. The Buddha had a central message, but he expressed it in a way that was going to work for people in his time and his place. And our situation is just really, really different. We have different problems from people living at the time of the Buddha. We have different strengths, and we have different weaknesses. Trying to practice simply in the same way that the Buddha taught for his particular time and place isn't necessarily going to be the best way for us. For a start, if we take his advice and go and live in the forest and beg for our food, we are likely to be very cold and very hungry. So it's not always completely applicable for us, actually. And of course, ever since the time of the Buddha, as times changed and the Dharma spread to different countries and different cultures, other people have faced exactly the same issue. They've faced this issue of trying to practice the Dharma in a different time and place. How do we find the vital core of the teachings? How do we find the essence of the teachings? The essential principles and values and insights and practices? And how do we separate those from the aspects of the teaching that just happened to be fitted to the time and the place that the Buddha was living and practicing? And then how do we put those essential principles, practices, insights, how do we put them into practice and live from them in this very different situation that we live in? So we're not the first people to face that problem. It's been faced as Buddhism went into new cultures ever since the time of the Buddha. And we can learn from all those people who've gone before us. We can tap into that great wisdom that the tradition has built up. And we can draw inspiration from it. We can learn from it. So of course we're going to be looking at the historical Buddha and his time and place, 2,500 years ago, about 5,000 miles away, sort of west and south. But we'll also be looking at how the Dharma's expressed itself in later times in India and in Central Asia and in China and in Japan and in Korea and Southeast Asia, etc., etc. We'll be looking at how people re-expressed Dharma in ways that can still fire us up, fire up our inspiration, and help us to practice really wholeheartedly right here and now in the 21st century. So that's what we'll be doing. But of course, all that started 2,500 years ago in northern India. 2,500 years ago in northern India, something happened. Something that's still influencing us here and now, all this time, later on, all those thousands of years ago. So 2,500 years ago in northern India, there was a sort of explosion. It was as though there was a crack was made in the walls that surround us, and light from beyond anything that human beings had experienced before streamed into our world. Or rather, this light streamed into the mind of one man. One man made a crack in those walls and the light came in and lit up his mind. He was enlightened. The Buddha was enlightened. The Buddha woke up to the real nature of things. And he woke up to a completely new way of being. And because he'd woken up, he was called the Buddha, which means the one who's awake, the one who's woken up. And when one person had woken up in that way, well, that's paved the way. That paved the way, it sort of broke a sort of barrier and paved the way for the rest of us to follow, if we're willing to make the effort. And that explosion, of course, sent out waves. It sent out waves of light that have spread down the ages and across the continents, and that is lapping around us here in this Buddhist centre. It's why we're in this Buddhist centre now. So over the coming months, we'll be looking at the different forms that wave has taken, if you like. Remembering how it all started, and with this explosion of awareness. So it's that explosion of awareness that I'd like to start with and to kick off our series and talk about tonight. So it all started with this explosion of awareness, this light breaking through, this enlightenment. Well, what was it? What was it? If we're going to base our sort of tradition on it, if we're going to base our practice on it, base our lives on it, what was enlightenment? What was it? How can we get some sort of idea of it? That's what I'm going to talk about tonight. How can we get some sort of idea of enlightenment? So, well, the obvious place to start is the Buddha, isn't it? What did the Buddha tell us about enlightenment? That should all make it completely clear. Then we all know, won't we? What did the Buddha say about enlightenment? Well, unfortunately, he didn't say very much at all, really. What he mainly said was, if I said anything, you're not going to understand it. The Buddha made it very clear that he couldn't just tell us what enlightenment was. He said the nature and the content of enlightenment could not be communicated in words. He said, beyond the realm of terms, beyond the realm of language, can't be communicated. So why? Why can't we communicate? Surely you can sort of talk about anything. I think we could get some idea of this, what that might mean, why that might be the case. If we think about, say, trying to describe the colour blue to someone who's been blind from birth. Say, we're trying to describe the colour blue to somebody who's been blind from birth and has never experienced it. And we might say, it's a cool colour, like the sea, like the water. Or we might say it's a really warm colour, like the summer sky. But none of those things that we might say about it would actually communicate the experience of the colour blue. In fact, they would probably seem really contradictory. Hey, well, he said it was a warm colour, and now he's saying it's a cool one. He clearly has no idea. So it would probably be contradictory and might be counterproductive. It might really lead people on the wrong path rather than be helpful. So the Buddha decided not even to try. He thought, he says this, well, if I describe it, you'd just get the wrong end of the stick, wouldn't you? You'd just sort of go off on one. So the Buddha gave plenty of teachings, but those teachings are about trying to tell us what enlightenment is. What his teachings were about is about how telling us how we can grow so that we can experience more of enlightenment ourselves, so that we can become more the sort of people who experience the same enlightenment that he had. How we can develop our own potential for enlightenment so that we can have some of that experience of enlightenment for ourselves. And only then will we know what it means. So we're told that the Buddha had this vision after his enlightenment, that he saw humanity as a lake full of lotuses. And so lotuses are like water lilies, and they grow in a gunge at the bottom of sort of stagnant lakes. And they come up through the muddy water, and then they poke their heads above the water, and then they open, and they're these glorious, pure, beautiful things coming out of all that murk. And the mud and the rubbish and the dirty water just completely rolls off them. So he had this vision of humanity as lotuses, all at different stages, some really down in the mud, and some sort of part way up through the water, and some just poking out through the water, and some just really ready to open. And his conclusion from this was that, well, okay, I maybe can't say what enlightenment is, but I can help the lotuses to grow so that they will unfold in the light. So an awful lot of the Dharma is not trying to tell us what enlightenment is. An awful lot of the Dharma is a horticultural manual for the growing of lotuses, with us being the lotuses. Okay, that's what the Dharma is. So the Buddha didn't tell us what enlightenment was. And if that's the case, how can we know anything about it? How can we know anything about it? And if we don't know anything about it, and it's the sort of key to our tradition, well, how do we know where we're going? How do we know we're anything like on the right path? How do we know we're not just completely deluded? How do we even know whether it's a good thing or not? We might find out what it isn't. Well, I don't know that. You know, it's a terrible thing. So how do we know? Well, I think there are three, at least there are more, but at least three ways. I can think of three ways that I can talk about in a talk that we can get some sense of enlightenment, of what it means, some glimpse, some echo, some taste, some feeling for enlightenment, long before we get anywhere near enlightenment ourselves. And the first way I think we can get some feeling, some glimpse of it, is from some of the mythic stories and archetypal images that surround, that are used to describe what happened when the Buddha got enlightened. So the Buddha got enlightened, and the traditional accounts don't say, well, then the Buddha figured this out, and then he sort of realized this truth, and then he realized that truth. He figured out that problem. They use mythic stories and images. The tradition uses mythic stories and images to communicate something of what actually happened in the Buddha's inner world. And if we let those mythic images speak to us, they can convey something about enlightenment that an abstract, logical description would not. So tonight, one of the things I'm going to do is briefly describe a few of these images to let you see what you make of them, to let you see if they do communicate some feeling for what enlightenment's about. So that's way one. The second way I think we can get some sense of enlightenment is from the teachings that the Buddha did give us. Okay, the Buddha didn't tell us what enlightenment was, but he did tell us how to move towards it. He told us which direction it was, which direction to move in to get to it. And I think that tells us a lot about enlightenment. So, for example, the Buddha taught the metta bhavana. He said, cultivate metta, and that's moving towards enlightenment. Logical deduction, enlightenment involves metta. Becoming more metaphor will move us closer to enlightenment. Enlightenment must be a state of very highly developed metta. So we can use the Dharma as a sort of signal, road sign pointing to where enlightenment might be. Well, there's an awful lot of Dharma. I could spend years doing that. So tonight I'm just going to talk about one little bit of Dharma, one of the few key teachings of the Dharma and what these can tell us. So that's the second thing I'm going to talk about. And the third and final way we can know something about enlightenment is from what as I can only describe as our intuitive connection with it. We all have the potential for enlightenment. And this potential gives us a connection to it. We have a sort of connection to enlightenment. And if we listen to that connection, if we can learn to listen to that connection, we can get a sort of glimpse, get a sort of echo, get a sort of feeling of what enlightenment might be. That might all sound slightly mysterious, but maybe I'll be able to make it a bit clearer later on. So those three ways, the archetypal stories and images, the direction markers that the Dharma gives us, and our own intuitive sense of connection with enlightenment. So, what about the first of those ways of getting a sense of enlightenment? The mythic stories and images that the tradition used to communicate something about what happened at the Buddha's enlightenment in his inner world. So I'm not going to say a lot about these. I'm going to sort of describe them and hopefully let them resonate, let them communicate whatever they communicate. Next week, we're going to have three short talks on three of these, and maybe we'll get, well, we will get an opportunity then to go a bit deeper into them, a bit more depth. Anyway, so just to give you a taster, the traditional story tells us that after his years of dedicated practice, the Buddha finally sat down under the Bodhi tree. He sat down under the tree of wisdom at a spot called the Diamond Throne, which is the center of the world navel. And on that spot, something new broke into the world. It broke into the Buddha's mind. And for me, at some sort of level, just this, just what I've described, says something about what happened. So, trees. He sat down under the tree of wisdom. Trees. Trees are pretty universal symbols. Their roots reach right down into the depths of things. Their branches stretch right up towards the stars, towards the sky and the stars. Trees connect heaven and earth. Trees sort of represent earth growing up towards heaven, but also drawing strength from the earth. The Buddha's enlightenment connected the heights to the depths. It connected heaven and earth. And then there's the image of sitting on the diamond throne. This image of the diamond seat, or the diamond throne of Vajrasana. Diamonds. We don't often get a chance to look at diamonds, but if you ever had a chance to look into a diamond, they are full of clear, beautiful light, full of these most amazingly vivid colours. And through this diamond seat, full of all this vivid light, where the Buddha sat in meditation, this light and this vivid colour, as it were, came through into our world, through the Buddha. In the writings of one medieval Japanese teacher, he encourages his followers, his disciples, to think of every meditation seat, every one of these little cushions, as a sort of, got a link back to the diamond seat. There's a sort of voltage flowing from the diamond seat of the Buddha to every single little blue meditation cushion or black meditation cushion. So that every time we sit in meditation, we're connected to the diamond throne. And some of that light and that vivid colour that came into the world through the Buddha's diamond seat comes into our mind as well. The Buddha opened the door, and through our connection with him, we share in his experience, we feel his influence. It could be quite a mythic way of just livening up your meditation, if nothing else, to think, it's, you know, that enlightenment is echoing, and it still comes every time, some glimpse of it comes every time someone sits in meditation. So the Buddha sat on the diamond seat under the tree of wisdom. And then we are told that as the Buddha was sitting under the tree of wisdom, he was attacked by Mara. Mara is a personification of everything that holds us back. Everything inside us and outside us that stops us growing, that gets in the way, that keeps us stuck in inertia. So Mara came to disrupt things. And Mara unleashed his terrible armies upon the Buddha. All sorts of horrific, distorted creatures with faces in their bellies and heads like goats and heaven knows what else. All these horrible, distorted creatures came out from under the stones, and they came out from the nooks and crannies like something out of a worst sort of horror film. And they hurled every sort of weapon at the Buddha. They hurled javelins, they hurled they shot arrows, they threw maces at him. They raced around chaotically and tore up trees and rocks and threw those at the Buddha. And they shouted threats and they banged pans and saucepans. And they made a right old racket and a chaos, all trying to scare the Buddha away from the seat of enlightenment, or at least put him off what he was doing. You know, you ever get distracted in meditation because someone's shuffling? Well, there was something more going on here. But then, so that was what's going on, this total chaos as Mara tries to disrupt what's happening. But then the traditional account gives us this amazing image of the Buddha seated inside his aura, an aura of light and peace. And inside this aura, everything, so to say, is peace and light and beauty amidst this terrible noise and chaos. And all the weapons that Mara's armies throw at him, they simply turn into flowers and they sort of rain down in this really nice, gentle way. As soon as they touch the Buddha's aura, as soon as they get within his sphere of influence, they just turn to flowers. They turn from something ugly and dangerous into something beautiful. So, well, here's a description of that from adapted from a traditional source, just that last little bit. It says here, as a forest fire stops when it reaches water, as an arrow bounces back when it hits a rock, as lightning is quenched when it strikes the earth, just so the aura of the Buddha repulsed the hordes of Mara's sons. When the armies of Mara crowded round him, the air was loud with screams, shouts, howls, and the cries of animals. But inside his aura, there was peace, and swans and peacocks circled the seat of enlightenment in a stately procession, paying homage. When the armies of Mara crowded round him, dust and dirt rained down, and the air was full of arrows, rocks, and flying spears. But inside his aura, these weapons turned into a rain of flowers, which carpeted the ground and hung in garlands on the tree of enlightenment. When the armies of Mara crowded round him, the ground was rocky and rough, covered with stones, thorns, and thistles. But inside his aura, in the place of enlightenment, the ground was perfectly smooth and made of spotless, shining gold. So I think this image of the Buddha sitting in his own aura, in his own, creating his own beautiful world amidst this chaos and confusion and hatred that surrounds him, I think there might be an image of enlightenment there that might tell us something about what enlightenment is. Might tell us quite a lot about the enlightenment. And then the traditional account goes on, when the armies of Mara couldn't distract the Buddha, and after he tried a couple of other tactics that I won't go into because I haven't got time, we're told that Mara tried to undermine the Buddha's self-confidence. He tried to undermine his confidence in what he was doing. So he challenged him. He said, "What right have you got, you petty little princeling? What right have you got to sit on a diamond seat of enlightenment? Who on earth do you exactly think you are?" Basically. And in response, the traditional account tells us the Buddha simply reached down and touched the earth. He made the gesture that our Buddha statue is making. He reached down and he touched the earth, making that famous gesture. And in response to this gesture, the earth rung like a bell. And the earth goddess appeared out of the ground and vouched for the Buddha. In other words, the very forces of nature backed him up. And just that image of touching the earth, just that image of the Buddha touching the earth, I think tells us a lot. It seems to me to say a lot, communicate a lot about groundedness, about connectedness, about complete imperturbability. About enlightenment. It speaks of one who knows, of someone who knows and can't be pushed around by anything that happens, and certainly can't be knocked off course by their own doubts and lack of self-confidence. And then the earth goddess appearing, well, the personification of nature, if you like, appearing, and giving the Buddha her backing, saying, "He's all right, I'm with him, you know, don't give me any trouble." That also seems to tell us something important. Getting a bit mythic myself, I think enlightenment is something that has grown out of nature. You know, we're human beings, we're the products of nature. The Buddha was a human being. It's the next step in evolution. Evolution brought human awareness into existence, and that is the next step beyond normal human awareness, even into enlightened awareness. So speaking poetically, it's a bit as though the universe, nature itself, is struggling to bring greater awareness, greater consciousness into existence. And we seem to be the cutting edge of that struggle right here and now, at least on this little planet. And the Buddha was the next step, the next breakthrough. So nature itself supported him. He was the cutting edge of evolution. He was the universe doing what nature was trying to do. So he had the support of nature itself. So the Buddha did break through to enlightenment. He sat in meditation all night. And then as the morning star came into view, he broke through the last veils. He broke through the last obstacles. So it was morning. I mean, that image of dawn, I think, says a lot as well. That image of dawn. You know what light is like at dawn? The way the morning star looks at dawn. That absolutely beautiful, limpid light. So it was morning. The night was over. The light had come back into the world. Just that image of the morning star and the dawn seems to me to say something. A new, clear light had come into the world. So that's not the whole story, but those are a few episodes from the story of the Buddha's enlightenment. Not meant to be taken literally, but trying to tell us something about the inner experience of enlightenment. And those images, I do think, for me, they can give us a sense of what enlightenment's about. And we'll look at them in more detail, some of them in more detail next week. So as I said, that's maybe the first way we can get a taste of it, of something about enlightenment, is through those mythic approaches. The second way I suggested was through the teachings, through the Buddha's teachings. As I said, the Buddha didn't try to tell us what enlightenment was. He told us what direction we should move in, how to move in the direction of enlightenment, what practices would move us in the direction of enlightenment. So that, and that in itself tells us a lot about the qualities of the enlightened mind. I could say a huge amount about that, but I'm just going to pick on one little bit of the teaching, because it crops up in the Buddha's very first discourse. It crops up in the Buddha's very first discourse, the very first way he thinks of to try and get something through to folk, so that they could move more towards enlightenment himself. And this is a teaching we're all familiar with, I should imagine. We deal with it on the intermediate course. And it's the teaching of the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path. Again, I'm not going to go into detail, but you probably all remember that the first of the Noble Truths is the Noble Truth of Dukkha. The Noble Truth of Dukkha. Dukkha meaning, it's often translated as suffering, it's a bit extreme. Dissatisfaction would be closer. Actually, it means something like ill-fitting. Ill-fitting cartwheel. But dissatisfaction, the truth of dissatisfaction. The truth of unsatisfactoriness. So the first noble truth tells us that life as it is normally lived is unsatisfactory. Or to put it another way, the first noble truth tells us that there is an inescapable element of dissatisfaction in our lives, the way we normally live our lives. We all experience dissatisfaction. If you doubt this, think what it would be like if we didn't experience dissatisfaction. We would never move. We would always be happy just where we are, just the way things are right now, for as long as it went on, etc., etc. We are motivated by dissatisfaction. We would never want anything, and we would be perfectly happy everywhere. We would never try and change anything. So we all experience dissatisfaction, and that's what the Buddha chose to focus on in his first discourse. And then, of course, the fourth noble truth tells us that the way to respond to that dissatisfaction is to follow a structured spiritual path, the Noble Eightfold Path, that helps us to grow, that helps us to use karma, to grow, to develop as a being, to become a bigger being, yes, to become a bigger, more aware being. And that is the way to deal with dissatisfaction. So the Four Noble Truths and the Noble Eightfold Path are about how we respond to dissatisfaction. And dissatisfaction is a great thing. I am a big fan of dissatisfaction. Without dissatisfaction, we would never do anything. Dissatisfaction moves us to create something better, to change things, to make something better. The issue is, what do we do with our dissatisfaction? How do we deal with dukkha? And one response that we often have to dukkha, to dissatisfaction, is to distract ourselves from it, to hide from it. We feel unsatisfied, so we reach for the remote control, we go on the web, we have a look at this, we have a look at that, we reach for the cream cake, we reach for the beer, we reach for the cigarette. We do all sorts of things to distract ourselves from that underlying sense of dissatisfaction. And the problem with all of those is that it works, but it only works for a very short time. When the pleasure of the beer passes, when the pleasure of the cream cake passes, when the car loses its novelty, the dissatisfaction is still there, as big as ever. That old dissatisfaction is still there. So a more constructive approach to dissatisfaction is to try to deal with its causes, to try to deal with it, to change things to make them more satisfactory. But if we want to deal with it, we have to deal with it in the right way. We have to actually recognise what the real cause of it is. And what we usually do when we think we're changing things to deal with our dissatisfaction is to blame that dissatisfaction on other people or the nature of things, you know, things like impermanence. So we try and blame the world, we try and blame other people, and we try and change them. Well, it's not really going to work, is it? And it isn't just that it isn't going to work. Well, it just isn't going to work. As Shakespeare says, one of his characters say, "The fault, dear Brutus, is not in the stars, but in ourselves." The root of the dissatisfaction is in ourselves. The problem is not out there. In other words, the problem is in ourselves. I've got another quote from the Sex Pistols. I don't usually use the Sex Pistols as quotes, but I've got another quote from the Sex Pistols. You won't find me. I don't know the tune to it. You won't find me working. Maybe I should get something on that. You won't find me working 9 to 5. You won't find me living for the screen. You're lonely and your needs are catered. You've got your brains dehydrated. Problem. But the problem is you. What are you going to do? Well, okay, I think you got it slightly wrong. You said the problem is you. The problem is us. Okay? The problem is us. What are we going to do? The root cause. Yeah, so we create the problem. I mean, of course we could improve the state of the world. But we create the state of the world. We create the problem out there, the sort of world we live in, by the sort of people we are. The problem is not in the stars, but in ourselves. Not out there. The solution has to start with ourselves, not out there. Not other people. We need to follow a path that helps us to change and grow into bigger, wiser, more compassionate, more metaphor beings. Not to tell other people they should change. That's not going to work. The root cause of our dissatisfaction is that we've got this tremendous potential as spiritual beings. We are spiritual beings. And most of the time we ignore that and live a sort of life that isn't worthy of us. We're living a life that's beneath us, and that causes huge dissatisfaction. And we try to deal with that dissatisfaction by running on this treadmill, chasing a sort of satisfaction from outer things, that we're just not going to catch that carrot. So we're always dissatisfied. So the way to deal with our dissatisfaction is to grow, to become more like the sort of being we have the potential to become. Being dissatisfied with where we are now is great if it spurs us on to change, to grow. So the whole key, in a way, that the Buddha's presenting in this first teaching is how to deal with our dissatisfaction. How do we deal with dukkha? Dukkha is the fork in the road. How we deal with dukkha is the fork in the road. And which fork we take determines whether we change in a way that really makes us more satisfied, more deeply happy, more fulfilled, or not. Whether we just carry on being more dissatisfied, more frustrated. So in the introductory course, you might remember, we present a sort of fork in the road as being the, what we call the gap. The intersection between the wheel that keeps going around and the spiral path that takes us somewhere new, that takes us somewhere new, to a better self and a better world. And we talk about the gap, the point of freedom, as being that point of intersection. In that gap, we make a choice. We have a choice between our usual comfort-seeking behaviour, hiding from dukkha and going back around the wheel, or doing something new and perhaps challenging, but creative, to set up something new, to become a new person, and start to create a new world. And that idea is sometimes expressed in a different way, where the fork in the road is put in terms of dukkha. So there's another way this is expressed, where the fork in the road is dukkha, the way we respond to dissatisfaction. So we have our wheel here. It's a slightly bent wheel. No wonder it's unsatisfactory. It's going to give a very lumpy ride, this wheel. Here's our wheel, and on the wheel arises dukkha. And the usual response to dukkha is, very often the response to dukkha is craving. So how am I going to deal with the fact that I'm unsatisfied? Hey, give me more pleasure. Hey, let's have some more possessions. If I had some more money, that would be fine. If I had a bigger house, a better car, a better phone, a better partner. If I had a glorious holiday, my dukkha would go away. But it never quite does it? Round the wheel. That way of dealing with dukkha. And the other way of dealing with dukkha is put here as being Shraddha. And I'll explain what that means for those who haven't come across the term. So that's saying the same thing as the teaching of the gap, but in a different sort of way. It's talking about our it's more general. It's sort of talking about our general approach to life. If we seek our happiness, if we make our life about hiding from dukkha by going into craving, we go round the wheel. If we base our life much more on Shraddha, to the sun. Well, we set up new creative possibilities. So, Shraddha, code, Buddhist code, Sanskrit word. For those who haven't come across it, what does it mean? You could describe Shraddha as our sense of connection to something higher, our sense of connection to enlightenment, if you like. Sangharakshita, the founder of the Tree Rama community, describes it as the response of what is ultimate in us to what is ultimate in the universe. The response of what's ultimate in us to what's ultimate in the universe. There's some sort of resonance. We have some sort of resonance with enlightenment. What's ultimate in the universe? We're connected to enlightenment through that response. Shraddha is our connection to enlightenment. We've got this potential for enlightenment. A bit like an acorn has got the potential to become an oak tree. Something that's tiny little acorn's got this potential to be this vast, beautiful oak tree. Something in the very nature of the acorn sort of causes it to do the things, to grow in the way that will eventually turn it into an oak tree. Something in our very nature prompts us to grow, prompts us to do the things and grow in the way that will eventually lead us to become a much larger being, indeed an enlightened being. We've got Buddha trying to manifest out of us in the same way that the acorn has got an oak tree trying to manifest out of it. And that potential somehow communicates itself to us. It gives us a sense of direction. It tells us which way to go, if we can listen to it. So we may experience this sort of intuitive sense of direction. We may just know that certain things are important to us. As soon as we come across them, I know that. I know I've got to do that. I know that's important to me. We may be fascinated by some things or some people. but have a sort of aura of importance for us, because deep down something is trying to tell us, yeah, that way, that's the way, that's, come here, it's our higher self calling us. We may experience it as a sort of intuitive heart knowledge about the direction we should go, how we should live our life, what is important to us. So what I think this teaching about how we deal with our dissatisfaction is telling us is, if we try to deal with our dissatisfaction, if we try to deal with dukkha by basing our life on trying to distract ourselves from it with pleasures, possessions, money, approval, a better house, a better holiday, if that's what we base our response to dukkha on, we're on the wheel and we carry on living on the wheel. But if we deal with our dissatisfaction by listening to our Shraddha, by basing our life on our Shraddha, basing our life on that voice that's telling us how to grow and whatever helps us to do that, the voice that's telling us how to become an oak tree, if you like, if we base our life on that, then we will move beyond our dukkha and we will experience a much deeper form of happiness. We'll still have pain, we'll still have sorrow, things won't always go our way, but hey, that won't matter so much anymore, because there'll be just something much deeper, deeper fulfillment and satisfaction going on. So the best way to deal with dukkha, and I think this is what this teaching is telling us, best way to deal with our dissatisfaction is to base our life on the voice, as it were, of what's happening within us that's telling us how to grow. And the things that help that, like the Dharma, like the Sangha, that help that, help us to hear that voice, help us to make that voice a reality. We base our life on our connection with enlightenment, base our life on Shraddha. So, hey, there's one of the Buddhist teachings, the first of the Buddhist teachings, and what that maybe tells us about enlightenment. So earlier I said there are three ways that we can get some sense of enlightenment, some taste of enlightenment, know a little bit about what it might mean. The mythic images used to communicate enlightenment, and what happened at the time of the Buddha's enlightenment, the teachings that tell us the way to go, and the third one I'm going to say is this Shraddha. It is this sort of heart knowledge, this connection to enlightenment that we all have. We've all got that potential for enlightenment, we've all got a connection to enlightenment, and through that connection we can get a sense of what enlightenment is like if we listen to the voice of our intuition, the voice of our heart. So as I said, Sangharaksha talks of Shraddha as the response of what's ultimate in us to what's ultimate in the universe, and there is something ultimate in us. There is something ultimate in us. We do have a higher self, if you like. We do have that potential trying to express itself, and we can listen to it. And if we can learn to listen to it and experience it more, if we cultivate that Shraddha, we may not be enlightened yet, but we'll be as close as we can get. We'll be actually experiencing something of what it means. So that really is the way forward, to cultivate that Shraddha.